It is Monday, May 29th, 2023. My name is Sam Seder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is a special bonus episode. For the past, I don't know, 8 years? Did you say 8 years, Matt, that we have been taking Memorial Day off? I mean, have you been here for 8 years?
I was trying to think about that. Yeah.
I think, yes, 2015, right, Matt?
2015, yeah. Not quite 8 years.
2015 was 8 years ago?
This follows
Isn't that still weird?
We generally take Memorial Day off. But today, we had just a perfect guest for Memorial Day. And so we decided to do an extra special added bonus episode. We have Greg Mitchell, who's been on the program many times. He is an author and a documentary filmmaker, a writer. At one point, he was doing what's going on there? Is there something wrong with my image?
I don't know why that happened.
That is weird. There we go. And at one point, he was, I think he had something called the editor and publisher back during the Iraq War, and was one of the few people who was like really amplifying the McClatchy stuff. Anyways, Greg wrote a book and did a documentary entitled Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. The book expands on the 27-minute documentary. Definitely worth a watch. We'll put the link in the description of the podcast and YouTube show today. Greg and I had a great talk about it. Really important, both from a labor perspective, from the perspective of the importance of the early reporting in setting the tone for history, and the not only for history as we look back on it now, but the trajectory of where movements go. This footage that was suppressed and really never was fully shown until this documentary, as far as I know, this footage that was suppressed could have really implicated sort of the direction of the union movement and the labor actions into, you know, the late 30s and 40s. I suppose one could argue that World War II would have derailed whatever movement happened there, but I don't know. But it's a fascinating story, and Greg is here to talk to us about it. Like I say, this is a special bonus episode, so we're only doing one version. I got a sponsor. But, you know, members can sometimes enjoy this stuff, too. The bedding that is currently on my bed, and I know that Emma has like a duvet. Is that what it is? And also, I've got a pair of joggers that I never thought that I would be wearing joggers or any type of like loungewear. And I am wearing these things, constantly. I am sure that you have heard of, Cozy Earth. We've certainly talked about it on this program. They have incredibly soft and luxurious bedding. There are literally thousands of five-star reviews on their site, and it's deserved. The best thing about this, this stuff is sustainable, but it also is just, and it's incredibly soft, but it is temperature regulating. The clothing is incredibly soft, but the amazing thing about the joggers that I sort of can't get over is that I never liked wearing things like that were that soft, because I didn't feel like it gave me, I need to go out with like both an emotional and a physical barrier to the world. And these things are both soft, but also like, I don't know, structured. I don't know how to All these products are made, like I say, from responsibly sourced viscose from bamboo. The bedding, like I say, soft and temperature regulating. And Cozy Earth offers a 100-night sleep trial. So you sleep on it, you wash it, you try it out. If you're not completely in love, which I find, frankly, impossible, you will just send it back and you get a full refund. You can check out their 10-year warranty, too. I've had sheets for a long time. They completely wear out after 5 years. Trust me. But these 10-year warranty. Right now, you can save up to 35% on Cozy Earth. 35%. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority. That is CozyEarth.com/majority. Be sure to enter promo code majority at checkout. You'll save up to 35%. This is all backed by a 100-night trial. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. Check it out. We will put the link in the YouTube and podcast description. And now, my interview with Greg Mitchell. We will be back live tomorrow. Check this out. And then go, honestly, check out the documentary. And then if you're like me, you'll be you'll end up going and getting the book, too. Quick break. Back in a moment. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is Memorial Day, folks. And this year we decided to do something a little different. We generally don't have a show, but wanted to cover this film that's on PBS. And I want to welcome to the program author and documentary filmmaker Greg Mitchell. He is the writer and director of the Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. I'm always happy to be here.
It's a 27-minute film, and it's fascinating. It is a piece of history that completely buried, and really it does make you feel like, how would things have been different had this footage that you have come across been actually presented to the American public in a legit fashion? But I don't want to get ahead of myself. This covers a massacre that takes place at the Republic Steel factory in Ohio or
South Chicago?
South Chicago, exactly. Illinois, right. Sorry. And just give us just set the table for us. This happens in 1937. What's happening in terms of the union drives and the movements at this point until we get to this day, really?
Right. Okay. Well, trying to do it in a nutshell, this is, of course, the midway in the Great Depression. Labor ferment was at a high point in the U.S. Starting around 1935, 1936. Workers were really forming the unions, and there had even been a wave of sit-down strikes, which was sort of a new tactic in many, many different industries, and even Ford and General Motors kind of caved in early 1937. So it was definitely a wave of union victories, some defeats, of course, flexing their muscle and so forth. So the giant steel company, U.S. Steel, made a deal with workers in early 1937 to give them things we take for granted today, like the 8-hour day and time and a half for overtime. But the so-called little steel companies, which were not little at all, but were somewhat smaller, like Bethlehem, for example, did not. And they were going to stand up. They were not even going to recognize the new steel workers union under John L. Lewis. And so they held firm. So the workers at these companies throughout the Midwest and Pennsylvania called a strike in late May. Were met in Chicago at Republic Steel with nightsticks by the police. Picketers were injured, sent to the hospital, arrested, and so forth. So that sets the stage for our story, which is that the workers in Chicago then called for a picnic on Memorial Day, 1937, with families and barbecues and kids and so forth.
And we're talking, we should say, we're talking thousands of workers, right? I mean, how many workers were there on that day, on Memorial Day?
Well, the crowd was probably about 1,500, but it was made up of strikers, workers, other workers who supported them, and women and children for, you know, for a Memorial Day picnic, 89 degrees and sunny. And so organizers then, as
let's, before we get to this part, what happens? Let's talk a little bit about a girl, Tom Girl, Gridler. Girdler. Yes. He was adamant that he was not going to negotiate with the union.
Right. Yeah. He was the head of Republic Steel, very anti-union. He had a famous quote that was, he'd go back to growing apples before he would negotiate or recognize the union. So he was holding firm, and the Republic Steel had a very cozy relationship with Chicago police. In fact, on the day of this massacre, the police were headquartered inside the Republic Steel gates. And Republic Steel gave them the tear gas they would use and axe handles that would supplement their billy clubs. So
the film said Republic Steel was the biggest purchaser of gas, of tear gas in the country.
In the entire country. Yeah, I know. Well, they expected, and they had trouble at other locations as well besides Chicago. So they were well equipped and ready, and the police were ready to stop anything that happened. And you know what happened was this crowd was asked by organizers to march towards the plant, which was about three blocks away across a prairie, open prairie, and establish a legal picket, which the mayor of the city had said would be okay. He said it was okay to have a legal mass picket outside the plant. So they were halfway there when the large contingent of Chicago police halted them.
Halted them, and I have to say, like the footage is really disturbing. And
it's kind of hard. You, no matter what you're expecting, it's far. It's worse than you expect. That's the terrible thing about it.
But the film is really not only about that moment, but all of essentially, I mean, it's an important moment, I think, in labor history that has been buried. But what's also fascinating is the mechanism in which it was buried and really the implications, I think, to it being buried. I mean, it's hard to sort of, we'll get to that in a moment, but how did we have access to footage at that time?
Okay. Well, a cameraman from Paramount News was on the scene. Now, as you know, and most people know probably, newsreels were a big thing then. This, of course, is before television, and also people were, even during the Depression, were going to the movies every week. It was a big, you know, it was big deal, like watching TV now. And so the newsreels were a very big deal. So one of the newsreels had a cameraman on the scene, and he was there at when the two contingents came together, the marchers and the police. And so he filmed almost the entire confrontation, as it happens, on film, catching the police firing and the police chasing the marchers and clubbing them over the heads and so forth, which we can get to. But that's why there is this kind of remarkable, unique evidence of 3 or 4 minutes of truly shocking, documentation.
Do you get a sense of how that Paramount newsman got there in the first place? I mean, because, you know, people have to understand that setting up a film camera to shoot new, it's not like it is today, obviously, where it's like someone can go out with their phone now. But even 20 years ago, you bring a video camera, you can get on the spot, things can happen quick. When you've got a film shoot like this, it's a massive tripod. You've got to set up in advance. You've got to load your film stock. You got to have someone behind you who's going to load up other reels, because at that time, probably, I would imagine, you know, you're shooting 16 mil and you've got maybe 3 minutes on your mag or 4 minutes. And so this is it's a production. How did they know to be there? Like, what did they think that they were doing? Was just going to be shooting a picnic? Or, I mean, it's not inconceivable, like a wave of unionization sweeps the country. Yeah. But it didn't. Was there a sense that this was going to be a compelling piece of footage or what? How did that happen?
Well, I think he was, I think the idea was that anything could happen. You know, it was a sense, okay, these people are calling a picnic. It sounds like it could be peaceful. Not much would happen, but they would know the police were massing. And that because there had been two nights before, these street confrontations where many the police went after a lot of the workers. And so there was a sense both sides were really geared up for something, but they certainly didn't expect anything like this. And I think the cameraman was there. I can't remember now. He had just shot the Indianapolis 500 or the Kentucky Derby or something. And so he went to Chicago and he was there. You know, he did B-roll.
Right.
Outside the factory and showed picketers and, you know, kids on bicycles and things like that. And then he was there for the, you know, for what was going to happen. So, you know, I guess it was fortuitous. But then, of course, what happened to his footage then became the most controversial thing of all.
Right. And we should say, as the premise for this, for what happens to the footage, is that 10 people were shot. And in these, well, let's take it as it was delivered at them in the moment, these clashes with these violent clashes where these, you know, they were called savages and there was a lot of racial implications and that they were high on marijuana. And they had attacked the police who, like you mentioned in the film, had huge stores of tear gas and axe handles in addition to sort of their regular police gear. And that was the story, that it was like a violent clash. And because there was no footage, there was supposed to be footage of it, but there was no footage released. Talk a right. little bit about what happened in that initial stage before we get to hearings.
Okay. Well, the two sides came together. There was sort of a heated discussion, but it didn't seem to be particularly leading to much. The police then gave an order to disperse, which the crowd ignored. There may have been a few rocks. There's a sort of difference of opinion, or a few rocks were thrown towards the police, and the police suddenly opened fire at point blank range, including there were women in the near the front ranks, and the crowd immediately fled, and the police kept firing pistols. And then they waded through the crowd. They chased people and hit them over the head. They waded through the crowd and beat people on the ground, you know, including women. And the whole incident, the violent part, only lasted about 3 minutes. But it was quite brutal. And, actually 40 people were shot. It was documented. The vast majority of them in the back or the side, like 80% of them in the back or side. And 10 died, within a couple of weeks. And then there were another 50 who were hospitalized with head wounds and other sorts of wounds. So it was a massive, a massive number of injuries and fatalities. On the police side, there were just a handful who required any sort of treatment for minor injuries. There wasn't a single major police injury. So it was rather one-sided. But as you started to say, the media coverage, both locally and nationally, right up to the New York Times the next day and in the succeeding days, pictured it as something the police had to do. The crowd was described as a mob. They were starting or intent on a so-called riot, and they were going to invade the plant and try to take over the plant, allegedly. And so that the only thing that could stop them was, police bullets and nightsticks. So the initial coverage for 2 weeks was very much pro-police. There's only one local reporter who is featured in the film and in the book. I've also written and published a book this week with the same title, Memorial Day Massacre, which is the first oral history of the tragedy. And so a lot of eyewitnesses are featured in the book, including this one local reporter who dared be skeptical about the police account.
And of course, ultimately, the footage becomes dispositive. Let me ask you one question about that footage. I mean, people should really check this out. It really is disturbing. There's sound too associated with it. Is that sound, the original sound?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Because the sound is almost more disturbing than the images on some level, because you get a sense of just how much they opened fire. This was not like one police officer. This was, it really
200 shots. That estimated 200 shots. Yeah.
It really has the feel of, like, because of maybe the location, and it has the feel of what you imagine a Revolutionary War fight would look like, but with one side without any weapons.
That's right. Yeah.
It's crazy in that regard. And then what ultimately happens, and it's also, this is, I found the film really instructive in terms of like the importance of reporting, and that first, the first reportage of an event really defines it for generations.
Right.
I think it's sometimes easy to forget that first narrative can really stick. And that's why it's so important. So Paramount was going to do a story on this, which basically means that they're going to run like a 3-minute reel.
Israel, yeah.
Before or after or in between a double feature in the theaters. And then they pull it, and you show parts of the reel, or at least explain part of it, and it's not it's tilted towards the cops in terms of reality, but they still pull it. And then they try and do it again, or they contemplate doing it again, and they still pull it.
Second one, yeah, they created a second one. When you say pull, it's actually they never put it out, so they. Right. It wasn't like it was distributed and then pulled back. They never distributed.
Well, did you get a sense of like why? Like what? Like where? You know, because it's attributed to the head of Paramount. But was it because the head of Paramount did not want this? They put out. Well, why don't you explain what they explained? And then I'm curious if you have a notion as to maybe what was influencing that decision.
Right. Well, the problem for Paramount. Was that as you said, the first newsreel had a very sort of pro-police bias in the narration. However, they did have to show some of the footage, and the footage gave lie to what the police narrative, even edited, gave lie to what the police were, what the pro-police line was. So I think Paramount put it out. Originally, it was about to put it out and felt, well, this is okay because our narration is pretty much blaming the strikers and so forth. But boy, those images are
right.
So their explanation to the people who complained was that they feared there'd be riots set off in the theaters, that people would riot in the theaters. Now you could say, well, that's a great excuse, or you could say, well, if they had seen all the footage, a week after it happened, there may have been riots, but nevertheless, it was a suppression of news, no doubt, and definitely favored the police and the company, in holding it back. And then, like you said, they did, when it became known that they had the footage, they did a second newsreel, which was a little more balanced, and they refused to put that out also. So we then come to 2 weeks later when the backlash begins, and we actually get the full story begins to come out.
What do you think? And I want to get to those hearings in a moment, and how the story does come out. But do you think? I mean, I know the ostensible reason is quite possible. I mean, I would imagine Paramount's not. Paramount has, I don't know if I believe the safety argument as much as I believe Paramount may have had corporate interests that didn't want.
Oh, sure.
This to drive a union, labor fervor, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Do you think that there was also, And I imagine maybe this is outside of the scope of the research you did, but that there were specific pressures applied on Paramount where people said, like, this is, you can't put this out.
Yeah, well, I wish I had a smoking gun on that, but that's nothing like that has ever turned up. I think it probably was enough that, you know, Paramount was a, still a conservative company. And the, I mean, the fact is, although we could say that there was great labor ferment at the time, and they had many victories, and I think there's a sense in our collective consciousness that, well, back in the good old days, people loved unions, and, you know, unions were hailed, and look at all the progress they brought. But in fact, at this time, in the media and by officials, they were, the organizers were largely pictured as radicals or communists or, you know, people who were, you know, anti-American and so forth. So it was, despite the growing strength of unions, it was a very heated time in terms of, you know, how they were pictured. So something that showed them as really victims and martyrs in this would have been, a little dangerous and unpleasant for a company like Paramount.
It would have driven sympathy for the union. I mean, I and these workers. I mean, it seems absolutely clear. And then also, we should say that this is a fairly nascent industry of news. Like, I mean, there's the level of sophistication. I mean, following this, there are hearings held. Mm-hmm. By La Follette, is that it? From Wisconsin,
great progressive, yeah.
And Wisconsin at that time was like, I think, you know, center that was well known for, you know, modern labor organizing. Really came out of Wisconsin at that point. And I think in the film, if I remember correctly, this is the first time there was a hearing on the Hill that involved looking at, I mean, visual, like, you know, a film, man. You know, but also, you know, any type of video, visual presentation.
Right, officially introduced as evidence. But to get there, I mean, the real turning point was 2 weeks earlier when, like I said, the media coverage stayed pro-police for a couple weeks. And then La Follette's committee subpoenaed the Paramount footage. And I mean, this may sound kind of familiar, modern day collaborations between Congress and the media, but so that La Follette subpoenaed the footage and then leaked it to a famous investigative reporter of the day, Paul Anderson. Anderson then wrote a two-part series for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the first real account of the film, which he described in startling imagery, and he interviewed some of the victims. Two-part series, it was then picked up by the New York Times and some other places. So the public opinion started to turn a bit, and La Follette then scheduled these hearings on Capitol Hill for 3 days at the end of June and early July, and called a dozen of the victims who were there, and a dozen of the police officials and, you know, rank and file. So it was a sensational hearing. So you went from, you know, this total cover up to now we're getting things brought into the light. And in these, the hearings then were very bad for the police. And they concluded really with the first screening of the Paramount footage, which was also shown into slow motion, which was also quite unusual at the time. You know, it was reported there were gasps and tears in the hearing room, and just, you know, it's like someone who watches my film today. I think probably they say, well, I understand it's going to be pretty hard, pretty heavy to watch. And then when you watch it, you say, Jesus, that's twice as bad as I thought it was.
Right.
So the same thing happened in 1937. So, the hearings then got a lot of publicity and attention, and the official report by the La Follette committee then blasted the police, said the police were, you know, fully to blame, and so forth. So, and I guess what I should emphasize here is that because of the, I guess only because of the La Follette hearings, Paramount then was forced to release a third version of their newsreel. And they put it out since they had no choice now. They distribute it, and they had this. The intro was, now it can be shown, you know, as if it couldn't have been shown before.
Right.
And straight from the La Follette hearings, and, you know, you've heard about it, and now here it is, unedited. And they then showed a good deal of the footage. But even as we know, as I note in the book and in the film, it was edited. They took out the first 15 seconds when the police were really, you know, you mentioned the gunfire and the sounds. They took much of that out. So even they were still lying, even when they were finally releasing the footage. And then another kicker is that after all that, the newsreel was banned in Chicago and St. Louis and even in liberal Massachusetts. Some chains refused to show it. So it did come out. A good number of people did see it. But even after all that, it still was, was hidden by the powers that be. And
that first 15 seconds too is incredibly powerful. I mean, folks should check it out. You've got firsthand accounts. Well, it opens up with the story of Studs Terkel. Basically,
one of my heroes.
Overall stories, and then accounts from individuals who were there. Are those, where did those accounts come from? Are those specific, the audio of the people who were there at that time?
Yeah, they were, it's kind of a long story I shouldn't get into, but they were recorded for a series that I was involved in 1992 called The Great Depression, which aired on PBS. And the audio from those interviews is still available. And I was able to get at it. It'd never been aired, these particular parts. Three different people who tell the stories first. Now, the film itself is narrated by Josh Charles, the great actor, but it's sprinkled with these audio accounts by, by eyewitnesses. So they're totally first person from that day.
And it tells the story of various people who approach it, including one woman, Lupe Marshall, who's a mom of three, a social worker who was beaten on that day, and different stories. And people should really check it out. But let me just ask, like, the implications once the film got out, even with that first 15 seconds, it really sort of and I think that there's a follow up as to the unionization happens, but even Republic ultimately unionizes, but it does feel like there is a deflation of the energy that had been there. That, like, despite the fact that ultimately it was the footage was partially released, that the efforts to suppress it were effective.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned yourself that the initial coverage is always more important than what catches up to it. You know, we've seen it 100 times, where the truth or the more balanced coverage that emerges never quite catches up to the impression that the first day or week or weeks will leave. So it happened here. It was a real setback, the public opinion turning against strikers, and they were all kind of lumped together like violent strikers. And so there was it was a setback for a while. But what happened eventually was that and the workers did return to work and, you know, ended their strike. But there had been a turning point in terms of it was recognized. You know, two things were recognized: that the workers basically got, you know, really were the victims in this and in several other places as well. And so the public opinion did start to turn more towards them. And they eventually, you know, within a year or two, they did win their demands. They did win the recognition of the union, which was the most important thing. And, but the other sort of interesting thing is, and it also is kind of amazing why so few people really know about this massacre, is it was the real turning point, as the last major confrontation resulting in anything like this level of casualties. You know, it's never happened again since then. They're very scattered, you know, here and there. And it kind of showed both sides the dangers of, you know, ratcheting it up to this kind of high level. And so, you know, in some ways, the unions, some people have said unions afterwards got a little bit too much in bed with the companies and managed to negotiate, you know, better contracts. But then some people complain they went too far. They were not militant enough. And of course, in some cases, people criticize the companies for caving. But this incredible massacre really kind of calmed things in a way that made people compromise. Like, we can't have this again. Even though the company was and the police were mainly at fault, we can't risk something like this where, you know, 10 die and 90 are hurt. So it definitely was a turning point, but all the more amazing that so few people know about it today.
I really got that sense that it was that the, I mean, because, you know, there, we have examples of the Chicago police.
Yeah, I was there in 1968.
Exactly. We have examples of the Chicago police, not exactly, you know, reforming over the course of, and, right. 1968, and then, you know, revelations about their black sites just, you know, 5-10 years ago. I mean, Chicago police, their tactics may have changed, but I mean, that's why when what got me thinking after that was, and, you know, we just recently did a story about how, you know, Reconstruction was, we interviewed about how Reconstruction, the history was lost, and a professor who had taken firsthand accounts from a Senate investigations that went around multiple states in the South and got firsthand accounts of during Reconstruction how there were basically white pogroms, right. You know, and of course we know how that worked out. It worked. It was able to erase that history, and it was able to disempower black people and in this country. And honestly, the feeling I got from that film was that the trauma that was imposed on these workers spread throughout the labor movement, and it made that there was a sort of like a fear that was embedded in the psyche of labor at that point.
Yeah, well, those gunshots carried a real message that was heard, and I get into that much more in the book, the companion book. But it's just even in the aftermath, there were, you know, protests and so forth, but nothing really was happening until the footage finally came out, which is, I guess, another lesson for today. You know, there's so many relevant things for today, including the controversies we have now with when police footage comes out of any assault on any black person or any person, then you wait for the footage, or you demand the footage. The footage comes out months later. Sometimes, how many times have we seen footage held up for months and then it comes out, and it's like, it's far worse than people even imagine. And so, you know, that's the same playbook as we saw back in 1937. So, but, you know, I think if people watch the film, and I should emphasize before it's too late that the film is now available for everyone to watch at pbs.org and PBS apps. You know, it's still screening on PBS stations around the country over the air. But most importantly for anyone listening to this is that you can watch it anytime you want at pbs.org and via PBS apps. It's up there for the watching anywhere you are in the country.
Well, we're going to link to it as well as to your site, and there's some trailers there, but it's, you know, like I say, it's 27 minute movie, and really, honestly, it incredibly poignant. Lots to think about, a lot of lessons to take from that. Greg Mitchell, always a pleasure. And people can find your book via your website as well, the companion piece. The movie is A Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. Really appreciate your coming on and talking about
thanks,
it.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks. Thanks to you again.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie. But finding out will make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid. For the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive. Between the 101 and the 5. Do you know takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Shifted in and out.